Hello and welcome to Curiously Morbid, a podcast for the curiously morbid people out there. You are joined by me, Danielle Waldron, and my co-host Dean Osgood, and this week we are looking into the upstairs lounge in New Orleans, which
was the victim of an arson attack.
Oh, thanks for finishing my sentence there, Dean. I've had a bit of a stumble every time we've got
to
that.
So I thought, do you know what? I'm just going to take control and I'm going to say the words.
I'm really grateful for Sorry. That as well.
That was probably that was really probably came across as being really rude. Sorry.
No, that came across as like relief.
I felt like you were about to. I felt like this is the bit where I can come in, and it's not rude.
You saved the
for
day.
For the thespians out there that will know when you're working with another actor, another performer, and you feel like the scene's about to drop, you keep the ball in the air, you keep the energy up, you keep it going, you come in, you help them out. That was a good example of me and Danny being on the same level, having the same amount of teamwork.
Aww, you're so good.
I'm really excited about this case because I don't know anything about it, but from what you've told me, the headlines you've given to me, I'm interested.
Yeah, so this case, it's one of those ones where you'd think there would be a little bit more about this because it's so big, and it's like a hate crime as well, and it was really horrific. Like, again, it's an arson attack. This isn't really something that we've done on the podcast.
No, we haven't looked at arson.
No, we haven't, and it's a crime, and it's
a really, really awful scares crime. Me.
Yeah, it's just because it's so dangerous, isn't it? Like, obviously, there's the saying, don't play with fire for a reason, isn't there? Like,
and we're on the back of recording this, and I know it's not the same, but on the back of recording this, it's just been bonfire night in the UK, and there was chaos with fireworks, bonfires, firefighters getting fireworks aimed at them, things getting intentionally set on fire. So, like, I feel like I'm already in a heightened state from all that happening.
Yeah, it can just get really out of control, can't it? And it's not nice.
Okay, so let's open the case. Insert noise.
That was me opening the case. Oh god. So, in the early 1970s, on the edge of the historic French Quarter and the bustling downtown business district, New Orleans Upstairs Lounge was a destination that was left intentionally obscure. So this was basically, the Upstairs Lounge was like a nightclub, and it was, you know, you had to like enter it in kind of like, not a very secretive way, but you basically had to know it was there to know, like, to go to this nightclub. It was very like hush, and obviously it was intentionally that way. This was an oasis for the city's sizable, but for the most part, strictly closeted gay male population. A lack of visibility was in many ways its most vulnerable commodity. So it was basically, that's the reason it was hidden away, because they needed it to be a discreet place for, you know, like people, like LGBT people, particularly gay men. To
yes.
Go and, you know, go and vibe, go and hang out and have fun. Which, again, makes this really
and
sad.
And everyone needs a safe space.
What we're going to go on to talk about. Everyone needs a safe space. And this was that safe space. And there were so many people that went there. It was a real, like a very friendly vibe was always there. And it was a nice place. And this is coming off the back of like the Stonewall riots that had happened in New York couple of years earlier, and obviously New Orleans is quite an open place, but even in the 70s it wasn't really okay to be gay, because you are still in the deep south.
In the 70s, like, yeah, I don't really feel really it was societally acceptable until like the late 2000s. I feel like there's still a massive stigma before 2005.
Yeah, I think so as well. I think, like, even now, it's so much better, obviously, but there's still, like, a lot more that could be better.
Of course.
Like, you still do get people just being, you know, like, arseholes, basically, all the time. And it's just not
Equality
needed.
Equality is a constant strive for acceptance, and we will get there one day.
Yeah. one day, and that's thank you for coming to our TED Talk.
Thank you very much. If you'd like to book me, go to Curiously Morbid Pod on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter. You can also find our Patreon at Curiously Morbid Podcast.
Oh yeah, we didn't plug that at all. Well done, yeah. Even though this was such a like a friendly place and somewhere safe, in 1973 this all sort of turned horribly wrong when the club was set ablaze in an act of arson that cost a staggering 32 lives. That lack of attention endured, the news barely picked this up at all. So like people barely even knew about it. Even people in their own local community didn't really know, because obviously it was kind of like a secret club anyway. So if you weren't in the know of this club, you wouldn't really be in the know of what's happened to it either. So an ordinary reaction in New Orleans would have been the kind of big funerals that you normally see. So for example, New Orleans is known for having like brass bands and like dancers and parasol twirlers and, you know, like making a really big deal and having like a remembrance ritual rather than a funeral. And so when big events like that happen, that is the sort of general thing that happens in New Orleans. But nothing like that happened for this. And this was a huge event, like 32 members of their, you know, community unfortunately perished. But obviously, because homosexuality wasn't really supposed to be talked about openly, when it was then thrust, you know, like into the open, because obviously so many people had been under this attack from this arson, it made a lot of the people in New Orleans panic, which is really sad because they've just been through such a horrific ordeal. And instead of getting any of that sort of sympathy that you'd expect from a community to pull together, it just wasn't there. There was nothing there. And the only thing I can think about is like in our lifetime is obviously it's not really similar because it's not the same sort of thing that happened, but an LGBT community being, you know, like under attack was the Pulse nightclub shooting, and like the outpouring of like love and support and things like that for those victims. And these victims from the fire were just totally, you know, like robbed of that, and it's really sad.
Well, yeah, but unfortunately at this time period it's nothing new. If you think about, this is just before the AIDS pandemic, and literally everyone turned their back on that.
Yeah.
So it's nothing new, is it really? People not supporting it. And to be fair, making that comparison to Pulse, it is nice to see how far we've come, that people did stand in solidarity with the community. So it is nice to see how far we've come.
So at the time, though, this did seem quite odd, because New Orleans was a place of sort of duality of LGBT people and obviously non-LGBT people, where they could just sort of like live like peacefully, if that's the way you want to say it.
Quite liberal, like San
Francisco. Yeah, so quite liberal. So it was quite strange that like, it was all of a sudden, because it was public, because obviously it was in newspapers and stuff, that kind of showed, you know, like where people's loyalties actually did lie, and they were like, oh no, we're not going to publicly, you know, go and support these people and stuff like that. I think it was very telling of what, you know, like the actual attitudes were, even though it seemed like a very liberal place at the time.
Yeah, but you've got to think about the country.
Well, yeah. So even though the city was quite liberal, it was still really heavily had like a very strong presence of a Catholic population, and obviously that just wouldn't be something that they'd support. Certainly not at the time. Undercover police would actually regularly conduct sting operations to catch gay men soliciting for sex in public spaces, and if they were caught and arrested, the ramifications in the wider world were like just awful. So your name would be associated with what would be considered like just horrific behavior, and like you were saying before, you'd lose your job, you'd lose your home, everything. Like if you were associated with that crime, that was sort of it for you. So, I mean, men going out and living their lives the way they wanted to, like going to this nightclub, and it was dangerous. It was dangerous for them to do that, because if the police went and raided it, you know, life could literally be ruined in the blink of an eye, which is just, oh.
And like they would do things, wouldn't they? Where they would do things where you could, where like they would check you were wearing the right clothing that was assigned to your gender and things like that. Because this, so this happened in 1973. And if you think about it, that was only 4 years after Stonewall, which was 1969. So there's that whole big backlash there.
Safe Space, the upstairs lounge, as it was known, was a well-known place for, obviously, the LGBT community, but obviously not really for other people. And this was specifically like more so for gay men, because unfortunately at the time there was a bit of a divide with the LGBT community as well. And so this one was... for the majority gay men that frequented this establishment.
Yeah, it was a very divided community.
Yeah, which is, again, it's just sad, isn't it? I'm glad it's not so much now, and that it's much more inclusive, because...
There still is, though, isn't there, today? Yeah. Like, I don't understand how people can be exclusive with their fight for equality.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? It's so strange.
Do not get it.
Yeah. So at this time, there wasn't, like, for instance, like, this was pretty much just gay men that would frequent this establishment. So that safety then that they had, they could be openly themselves and they could go there and they would know, like, everything was fine. They'd go through this, like, sort of secret entrance at the back and just go and have a nice time, generally. But on the 24th of June, 1973... the lounge, which only had one public entrance and exit, so it was kind of like, you know, like how a cul-de-sac, you can only get in one way and out one way, which obviously is not safe. Obviously, it was set on fire on purpose, and it was set on fire near the door, so obviously people couldn't actually escape. It was upstairs, and basically you would jump to your death or you'd perish in the fire, which is just... It's so frightening. It's so scary. It's hard to imagine that.
It shows how sadistic people are in doing things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Knowing that, like, oh, there's absolutely no way for them to get out. It's really, really horrible. Mm-hmm. And this was actually the mm-hmm. deadliest U.S. incident of violence against an LGBT population until the 26th club shooting in Orlando. So this was, like, the worst one they'd had until, obviously, that shooting that we spoke about before.
Oh, Pulse.
Yeah, it
that
really
tragic.
Is. It's horrific.
Both of these events are tragic.
So the likely perpetrator was a troubled and violent person who'd actually been there quite a few times. Like, he'd frequented this nightclub, and he'd been ejected from the bar moments earlier after having a fight. And as he was dragged out, his jaw was actually broken as well. He was called Roger Dale Nunes, and he's reported to have yelled as he was being dragged out, "I'm going to burn you all out." So that's kind of hinting that
that's like a confession. Not kind of hinting. Yeah. If you say you're going to do it, then you do it. You've
so,
done it.
Yeah. And then it happens literally minutes later. So within minutes, the entrance was then doused in lighter fluid, bought from a nearby pharmacy, and then sparked into flames. And so two and two together, if they've managed to track where obviously this lighter fluid came from, it's quite obvious, because he's obviously just gone and bought the lighter fluid and then just done it. You know, again, it's quite sad, because it's like, well, was he drunk? Was he just like, what was the fight about? Why was he so, like, what was going on there to make him do that? You know, like,
well, some of the most homophobic people are gay themselves.
Oh yeah, yeah. Of course. Well, yeah, we spoke about that a little bit in the boys in the band over on the Patreon.
Oh yeah, we did. Nice segue.
Well, yeah, I didn't mean to do that, but that is just genuinely we did.
Yeah, we did.
Because one of the characters in that is quite homophobic, even though it's heavily implied that he's a gay man as well.
No, he is a gay man in that. It's not heavily implied. He's a gay man in that.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, he is.
What was the fight about? Do we know?
Well, no, not really. We just know that he'd had a fight and then he sort of left, basically. But yeah, so within minutes, that obviously it had gone up in flames, and it just happened like that. the more interesting sort of thing is that Numez was never actually arrested for the crime, even though it was really obvious, like the evidence all pointed towards him, the physical and the circumstantial, and he was never arrested or like pursued for it. And obviously a lot of people think that was because the police didn't really care, like they didn't really want to arrest anyone for it, like they weren't
it's very typical, isn't it? They don't want to acknowledge it. They're so bigoted that like they don't want to waste their time.
Yeah, basically, with the procedure, yeah. Even though it was like almost like an open and shut case.
Someone should have been prosecuted for this. Literally, how, if that's your evidence and you've got the evidence from buying it and he said it, that should literally just be open, shut, get to court, you're in prison for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I know, it's just ridiculous. But then Nunes also died by suicide the following year. Yeah, so I think a lot of that was guilt. So for me, obviously, we don't know because unfortunately the police didn't go and interview or, you know, like follow any of that up like they should have. But for me, just looking at this, I feel like obviously it was guilt, and this might have been a moment of obviously like that sort of frustration. And he's done it, and he's been drunk, and he's been angry, and then all of a sudden, two people are dead, and he's got to live with that guilt.
That's a heavy cross to bear, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, massively. Come forward and say it was him. Like, he never went and confessed to it or anything like that. The only sort of things we have, obviously, are the evidence of what he said, I'm going to burn you all out. And then, obviously, moments later, it's set ablaze.
Because on the flip side, if he didn't do it, he might have been survivor's guilt.
Yeah.
The reason why he killed himself. So obviously there has not been a trial, so innocence until proven guilty, we can't cast those type of aspersions.
It is sort of reported that he was sexually conflicted, and but obviously we don't know like the official reason why he was being thrown out of the club and like why he'd gotten into a fight. That's sort of all that's hinted.
But that is a common media trope, is it not? If you think about the Pulse shooting, that was all the media reported about the man that done it. Him being conflicted about his sexuality. And I don't know whether they try and use it as an excuse or try and use it as a get out, or they literally just don't know how to report on this case without trying to cast aspersions on someone's sexuality.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? And it's like, even if they are sexually conflicted, it's still a very horrific thing to do, and it shouldn't be their kind of like go-to, I guess, because it's like a trope, isn't it? It's very like,
I think the media often use it as a means of justification or means of like, I don't know, being like, oh well, this is clearly why he did it, because he was sexually confused, which is actually quite homophobic and damaging, isn't it? Because then it's like saying that anyone who has these feelings could do something like this.
Yeah, that makes total sense. That makes perfect sense.
Institutionalised homophobia is what it
is. Oh yeah, massively. So obviously 32 people unfortunately died in this inferno. A lot of those people, again, it took a really long time to get them all identified and things like that, because lots of them either like didn't take their IDs out with them because they were scared, like obviously if the police, you know, like were to raid or something like that and found their ID.
It was a common thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
To not do it.
Yeah, exactly. Then they that was their way of sort of protecting themselves. But then a lot of people didn't actually want to, you know, like go and come forward and look for their like people who were missing and who they thought might have died in the fire, because then they'd be sort of associating themselves. Admitting that person was gay and things like that. So it was very messy for a really long time to get everybody identified. And it's so awful because it's just like buried in stigma and all these poor people who unfortunately passed away because of like the bigotry, really. It's really hard.
Isn't homophobia shit?
Homophobia
why?
Is really shit. And it's like,
and transphobia and biphobia.
All of the phobias are shit. as well, I know we keep mentioning the Pulse shooting, but the Pulse shooting actually inspired a brief public re-examination, this upstairs arson attack. And some evidence of it was resuscitated all of a sudden. And a lot of publications that for decades wouldn't publish a word about the fire all of a sudden were, because obviously Pulse was a huge news, wasn't it? It was massive, you know, at the time, a huge tragedy. And so a lot of people then started reporting on this old one as well, which, I mean, I'm in two camps about that, because yeah, they should be reporting on it because that was a horrific thing that happened. But it's kind of like, oh, well, bloody too little too late. Like, it happened a long time ago now, and now you're just picking up on it.
Yeah, they're reporting on it for a selfish reason, because they're realising that people are interested in it and it sells newspapers or it drives traffic to your website. That's why they've done it after the Pulse shooting. And to be honest, that's part of the institutionalised homophobia. So I know this is not a TED talk about institutionalised homophobia, but you have to call it out when you see it.
Oh my God, yeah, of course you have to call it out. It's just, oh, it's just, it's really hard. It's not okay. And something else that's not okay happened with like the funerals and the memorial services. So many churches actually refused to hold funerals for the dead. Reverend William P. Richardson of St. George's Episcopal Church agreed to hold a small prayer service for the victims on the 25th of June. Approximately 80 people attended the event, which, if you think about it, there was 32 people that died. And if you think about things that happen to a proportion of the community, like when something horrific has happened and there's been some sort of an accident or an incident and a lot of people have died, the amount of people that will go to a tribute or a ceremony, and these had 80 people attend for 32 people. It's shocking.
It shows how nasty people are.
Yeah, because the, like, again, something I can compare it to is when we had the Manchester bombings there, and the amount of people that went, like, tributes and things like that. I just think of, like, images of, like, you know, all the flowers that were being left in Manchester.
Oh, that was heartbreaking.
Horrible. But people were showing their love and showing their support, and it's like, well, where was the love and support, you know, like, back in the 70s for these poor people who had to perish like this? It's horrible.
But what also we need to consider as well, I imagine that a lot of people will be grieving behind closed doors, particularly parts of the LGBT community that didn't feel like it was safe enough for them to come out. I imagine that the community itself will have held their own ceremonies in their own way, or celebrated their own way in private, because obviously at this time it might not have been safe.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? It's like these poor people who would have had friends and stuff like that, and, you know, like people who they might have, you know, like gone with to this nightclub, they can't even grieve. Do you know what I mean? It's so sad. It's so sad.
Shit.
It is. It's really shit. Really, really, really shit. So the next day after that small ceremony, Iverson B. Noland, who was the Episcopal Bishop of New Orleans, so the same church, he actually rebuked Richardson for hosting the service. And he basically really, really, he was adamantly against this. And him and Richardson had like this massive falling out. And Richardson's mailbox then was filled with, like, hate mail because... which is just so sad because he sort of... Because he was the bishop, obviously a lot of people, like, listened to this then and were aware that this ceremony happened. So he was, like, ridiculed Richardson for, you know, like, doing his job, by the way.
Yeah.
It's your job to support people and help people through tough times as a reverend, isn't it? You know, like, it doesn't matter who they are. It's your job to just help them and guide them.
Yeah, and it should be in an unbiased way. You should be providing a safe space for people.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, it's so horrible. It's so horrible.
Quite Richie, and I hate when people use religion as an excuse for it, because you tell me one religion that has hate in it. I can't think of one. Yeah. Every single religion that I know has love, peace, and respect at the core of its religions.
It's very sad.
This is getting me very angry.
Yeah, it should do. But as a kind of like nicer thing, there were actually soon after this, two additional memorial services that were held on July the 1st at the Unitarian Church and at St. Mark's United Methodist Church, and they were headed by Louisiana's Methodist Bishop, which Louisiana, again, a southern state, so the fact that their bishop is coming forward and basically, you know, like saying, no, this is okay to do, that's a really big deal, do you know, like, and the fact he went and like put his neck on the line, he was called Finnis Crutchfield, and it was also led by another reverend called Troy Perry as well, and he came over from Los Angeles to participate for this. So that shows how, you know, like how impassioned he was, because he traveled all the way from Los Angeles to go and do it. That's a big distance, isn't it, in America? Mm-hmm. So there's some positives, because some of the church obviously did go in and help and, you know, like try and do what they could, because I think they realized obviously what was going on with like the mourners and things like that, which is just so sad. But again, another little point about the mourners as well, they had to exit through the church's main door rather than an available side. And this was basically, this was a demonstration by the mourners of a new willingness to be identified on camera. So they did this purposefully.
I thought, hang on.
They did this as like a peaceful protest, you know, to be like, no, like, we don't care, we're gonna come out on camera anyway, which is really
yes
lovely.
Queens,
yeah, exactly, but
or kings or non-binary
or whatever the hell you want to be.
Yes people.
But like we were saying before, several families however didn't step forward to claim the bodies of the deceased. A few anonymous individuals stepped forward and paid for three unknown men's burials, and they were buried with another victim identified as Ferris LeBlanc in a mass grave at Holt Cemetery. LeBlanc's family would not learn of his death in the arson attack until January 2015.
What?
Yeah. That's how bad this was. Like, there's three victims that still have not been identified, and they're all in this grave with Ferris LeBlanc, who managed to get identified, I'm guessing, through friends or something like that. But his family didn't actually learn of his death until 2015.
So they must have known he had passed away, but not how he died. That's phrased wrong, isn't it? Because...
What? You
would assume that someone had died if you hadn't heard from him in 45 years.
Yeah, you would assume, but obviously they didn't know that was like he died then in this, which is just, it's just crazy, but it's just not okay. However, in 2018, Robert L. Camina, who was the director of the Upstairs Inferno documentary, which if you have not watched that documentary, please make it a priority. It's so, so good. He went and conducted loads of interviews, family members, did lots of his own research, and he announced after some extensive research that one of the three unknown men was very likely to be a 32-year-old called Larry Norman Frost. And so he's managed to bring, you know, like a little bit of closure to that family as well, because obviously some of the bodies as well wouldn't have been identified, not because family wouldn't come forward to try and identify them. This is obviously quite not very nice, but the way that they died, obviously they weren't very identifiable, some of them. Yeah. So it would have been because of that as well, and also the fact that a few of them wouldn't have had ID on them. So if the body was unidentifiable physically and they didn't have ID on them, that makes it an insanely hard job, because of obviously they were trying to be discreet when they were going to this nightclub. So a lot of them might not even use their real names when they're there and things like that. So it was very difficult. But well done to Robert Camina, because that's such a good thing to do, to go and do all this research that should have been done by the police.
Oh, yes, that's their responsibility. That's quite literally their job.
There are still two unidentified white males to this day, which it's horrible. So,
well,
it's just not a pleasant one. It's sad. Not a pleasant one. It's really sad.
Interesting, and I think we need to talk about it. I think people need to be aware of it. I think people need to acknowledge and respect these victims. I think people like us need to acknowledge the institutionalized homophobia that has led to the way this case was handled. And I think it should be talked about. The podcast should be done about it. So here we are.
Yeah, so here we are talking about it, bringing some light to it, because it's just... It was just awful, an awful, awful time. And finally, they've got a bit of, not justice really, because obviously no one was ever arrested for it, but there's a bit of closure there for some people who might have needed it.
Yes. Danny, can we leave some links in our show notes to some LGBT help resources?
Always, of course.
So you can find them there. Yeah. Oh.
I know, but yeah, so like you said, this one is, it was a sad one, but it is one that needs to be talked about. And like I said, please do go and watch that Disco Inferno documentary if you haven't seen it, because it is absolutely fantastic. And there's lots more detail and background on like some of the victims and their lives and things like that, family interviews. And so it is, it's just really, really good. So I would highly recommend going to...
I'll watch it.
That as well. All right, you've convinced me. Right. I'll watch it.
Oh, you've twisted me arm.
Maybe we could watch it and do like a bit of a Patreon review on it as well.
Yeah, let's do that.
Well, you could watch it. I've watched it.
I'll watch it now. I'll talk about it on Patreon.
It's a really good one. But that is the case of the upstairs lounge fire for this week. So that is our case file.
Thank you for tuning in and listening to us. You can find our social medias at Curiously Morbid Pod. We're on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. If you are generous enough, you can find us on our Patreon at Curiously Morbid, where you can donate from £1 or whatever your value currency is. But the good stuff starts at the $5 tier. We're doing reviews on film, TV. We're going to start doing cases that we're not going to upload here. And we'll be a Patreon only exclusive. So come and join our Curiously Morbid family over there.
Curiously Morbid family. I love it.
Danny, what's our Freaky Friday going to be about this week?
Oh, our Freaky Friday this week is going to be on the Pendle Witches. And this is like kind of local, but not too local. So, a bit of UK history. Because I thought everyone does the Salem Witches, don't they? So we're going to do the Pendle Witches.
Nice. So join us on Friday for that. But in the meantime...
Stay curious.
Stay morbid.
This has been an Audio Bear production. Our show tune is Half Mystery by Kevin MacLeod.
Yes, MacLeod.